Hello, Michelle Laurie here, and as promised, I am thrilled to announce that our tickets for Australian True Crime Live are now available. Join me in Sydney, Brisbane, and or Melbourne this July. You can come to all three if you want. These tickets are expected to go very quickly, so be sure to secure yours by visiting the link in our podcast bio, or you can head over to the Australian True Crime Facebook page. There'll be a nice link there for you. If you've been a listener for any length of time, you'll know how passionate I am about true crime stories from Australia. I'm looking very forward to an incredible evening together with you, sharing these captivating tales. We will have great guests as well, so you know, we love a Q&A. If you've ever come along to an Australian True Crime Live gig, you'll know we love a Q&A with our guests. Don't miss out. Book your tickets today, and I'll see you in July for a memorable night out.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
Captain.
Dear Cousin Charles, by the time you receive this letter, I shall be in my final resting place. I bequeath you a magnificent ancestral home we call Chapelwaite.
What do you think? I hardly know what to say myself.
Hello and welcome to this special bonus episode of Australian True Crime. It's a bit of a cheeky one because it's not actually about Australian true crime at all, but it is about something we thought you might be interested in, which is a new television adaptation of a Stephen King story. Chapelwaite is a new series now streaming exclusively on Stan, and it's based on Stephen King's short story, Jerusalem's Lot. It stars Adrian Brody and Emily Hampshire, who played Stevie on Schitt's Creek. You can start your 30-day free trial today at stan.com.au and see all of Chapelwaite. There's a link in the show notes to this episode that'll take you right there. But be warned, it's very scary.
Our guest for this special episode is Justin Smith, journalist, author and commentator. He's a regular on Channel 7 Sunrise, Sky News and writes for the Herald Sun in Melbourne. Justin's a Stephen King fan, and he found King's book called On Writing to be an inspiration when he turned his hand to writing fiction. Justin's first novel is Babies of the Rose.
Only I can save you. Hurting my family.
I think one of the great things about Stephen King is you can come at him from different angles. You know, you can come in through the short stories, you can come in through the horror, you can come in through the thriller type one, and it doesn't, he's the kind of guy, it doesn't matter how you get into him. You don't need somebody to say to you, oh, if you haven't read this, then you haven't read Stephen King and blah, blah, blah. It's not like that. You can just get in, slide into him whenever you feel like it, and you can also slide out whenever you feel like it. I think he's that good at what he does. It just doesn't matter.
Yeah, you're so right. And I find that I often, you know, whenever I pick up a Stephen King book, I always say to myself, God, why aren't I reading Stephen King all the time? It's so great, you know, and then I forget about it for years on end. And I don't know why I do that, because he's prolific and he's just masterful. I mean, I never, ever pick up a Stephen King book and think to myself, oh, this one's not good. This one's not great. They're all so great.
And I think, and he's been stamped with the horror thing. So if people haven't read anything else, they'd just say horror this and horror that. But he's far bigger than that, because the writing is so clean and intelligent, but it's also very human as well. So he doesn't just say, I'm going to show you a knife and a chainsaw and then I want you to be scared by it. It's always about how the human saw the knife and the chainsaw and what that did to them. So that's just for the horror part of it. But he's got a sentimentality that he, everything he does, he looks at it from the human point of view, you know, the way it smells, the way it tastes, you know, all the tricks of a writer. But he's always coming from the human angle. It's never just this blood and guts kind of, you know, tacky sort of horror. There's always something human about it.
Everything, and the humans, you know? The humans are always really fallible, and they're all looking at the situation through the filters of their own experience and their own failings and their own sort of sensitivities. But unlike his writing, the adaptations of his work have been very patchy. There are great adaptations and there are terrible adaptations, and there are adaptations that are so bad that he personally has disowned them and he's fought with people who've adapted his work. Can you talk to us about some of the more famous or infamous adaptations of his work that have gone before?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I would, let's start down the bottom of the pit, right down the bottom, which is a movie that he wrote and then he directed, which is, and for some reason I love it, and I think it's because there's some AC/DC tracks in it, because he was a fan of AC/DC and they agreed to give him some songs. But there was a film called Maximum Overdrive. It's the worst bloody film that has ever been made in the history of the planet. My wedding video is more captivating.
Gosh, I Maximum don't even know it.
It's awful. And what it is, it's about machines. And it's got, who's in it? Emilio Estevez, in a particularly low point in his career, took on this thing, and it was about machines, like cars and pinball machines and anything that was a machine turning on their owners and getting them. Now, if you think it sounds bad, brilliant, times that by 20, and that's how bad the film actually was. Mm-hmm. And King laughs about that because somebody said to him, you know, like, oh, have you ever thought of directing a film? And you know, he says, look, are you kidding? Have you seen Maximum Overdrive? Have you seen that film and how bad it is? And he says it's appalling. So let's go up the other end of the scale, and you've got Shawshank Redemption, which tops the list of so many people's top three films. Mm. You know, you wouldn't have to stray too far before you find somebody saying how wonderful it is. Mm. And you've got There's a great story that Stephen King tells about that, where he said,
"Yeah, that's great."
A woman came up to him and said, "Oh, you're Stephen King." She said, "Oh, I don't really like your kind of writing. Don't take offence to this. I don't really like, you know, the ghouls and the ghosts and things. I don't really like that. I like uplifting stories like Shawshank Redemption. Have you seen that?
How funny."
So, and then you've got Green Mile, which is. Beautiful. Just absolutely superb. And then Christine's and Cujo's and those, I think they probably sit in the middle. But he's, as far as adaptations go, he's had some triumphs, some absolute triumphs in there.
Well, the interesting one, though, for me is The Shining, because The Shining is people think is a triumph of a movie. I'm one of them. I love the movie. It's got a cult following like very few other films have ever enjoyed, and yet he hated it so much that he made a three-episode miniseries himself to kind of avenge it. I mean, why did he hate that movie that so many of his audience, of his fans, think is a stunning achievement?
Now, I think the way the story goes is that he had he wrote it and he thought this will make a terrific film. He wrote a screenplay for it, and then I think in between that, at some point, Stanley Kubrick bought the rights to it, or got involved in the rights to it, and said, "Oh no, that's fine. Don't worry about it. I've written a screenplay," and then went ahead and made that. And I just don't think it was really what King seemed to have in mind, and that's where it all went to hell, which I believe Hollywood is about a great deal, is that writers have something, they have a vision, and it just doesn't come out.
I guess it's always, you know, it's tricky, isn't it, to hand over your work? I mean, you're both writers. To the idea of handing over your work, your vision, to anybody else to turn into something, to turn into a visual creation is pretty scary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I really love, for me, I love, you know, the film Stand By Me, being a child of the 80s, you know, I absolutely love that film. And I never realized until after I'd seen it that that was based on a short story called The Body, a novella that Stephen King had done for a book, I think, Different Seasons. And so that's how I sort of probably had my entry to Stephen King as a reader, because I actually love Stand By Me and I've watched it with my kids. It's a bit of a classic, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm.
But Justin, you've had the experience recently of publishing your first novel.
Yeah.
I know that you're working on another one.
Yes.
You very kindly gifted me this beautiful Stephen King book. And I'd say your writing is very, it's almost poetic and very emotive. And
it's very kind.
And I know that you've mentioned that, you know, you drew a lot upon Stephen King's advice in this book for it. So what have you taken away from Stephen King for your own writing?
The reason I gave you that as a gift is, as you said to me, that, you know, you're keen on writing some fiction, and I don't want to crush you too much. I've given this book to a couple of people, actually. There's another person I gave.
Oh, Justin, I thought I was the only one. I
thought you were the only one. That's right. But it's what's gorgeous about the book is he writes about what he loves about writing. But he also goes through the process where he says, you know, I get up in the morning and I watch CNN for about half an hour. He says, because he's very political, he watches CNN for about half an hour, has breakfast, talks to his wife for a minute, and then he goes to his room with a pot of tea and writes for 3.5 hours nonstop. And King, I think King writes about 6 pages a day or something like, you know, that's what he kind of aims for, and then does nothing for the rest of the day, which sounds like a gorgeous, gorgeous kind of existence to me. But in that book, and look, anyone who's a King fan, you don't need to be interested in writing, but if you're a King fan, I think you should read it, because he talks about, first of all, the magic of writing, where he sort of goes into I think it's a pink rabbit, and he writes about a pink rabbit, and he says, now, this is the date that I'm writing about this pink rabbit, and he puts this date down from the 90s, and he describes what it's like in his house and the second he's sitting there. And he said, but I don't know when you're reading this, but you can now see the pink rabbit. He said, that's kind of magic, and that's one of the great things about writing. It doesn't matter when I wrote it. It just matters when you read it. And he talks about things like the plot. You know, he doesn't really have a plot in mind. The only thing he has in mind is, and this is something I've really picked up on, is all he has is the idea and the characters to carry it out. He doesn't say, well, this happens and then this happens and this happens. He says, I want to write about a car that's possessed by the devil, and I want a young man and an old man to tell a story. And then he starts writing and he's away. And he said if he's got a plot on how it's going to unfold, that spoils the story for him, and he will just sort of get bored with it because he already knows what's going to happen. So that's how he writes. Now, I think, firstly, that's incredibly difficult and takes a lot of talent to be able to do that, for him to do it so well. But I just love that. I just like the way that he's, as he's writing it, you can almost picture him saying, well, I don't know where this is going, but... We'll stick around and we'll sort of do it together. I like that. I think any writer can do that. It's extraordinary.
That's amazing. So I guess he must have to know his characters very well.
Look, from what I can pick up from the book, I think he has a pretty clear idea in his head on how the character feels. And I think, isn't that, you know, if I met you two have worked together for a long time now and have done great things together. And if I were to take one of you away and then mention the other one to you and say, look, before you, this is how it is for me, before you even picture their face or before you hear their voice or you can describe something that they like, you have a feeling about that. You feel that person straight away, you know. And I think that's what he's able to do. He has a feeling for that person, and then that feeling just goes through the book.
Mm-hmm.
And bless him for that, because I think anyone who's able to do that, you know.
Mm.
And Justin, that's something I got a sense of reading your first book, Babies of the Rose. And, you know, you've had a lifetime of getting a feel of people because you have a background in radio producing and media. So tell us a bit about that and, you know, how you've come to, I guess, you know, really have that feel for people. That's what I got the sense of reading that book.
That's lovely. And thank you. I don't know. I just, I wish I had a strong answer for it. I guess I just find people kind of just ridiculously fascinating. You know, and I like thinking what they're going to be thinking about something and why they would react to it. And, you know, it's the old one. I think it's more of a journalism mantra, but, you know, everyone's got a story. And if you can sort of create a character, then you try to understand what that story is. You know, I don't know if I'm answering that very well because I'm a little bit confused by it myself. To be honest, I think I just find human reactions to things really fascinating and the way that they do, the way they do things, why they do them. And in journalism, I like to try to tap into that as well. And with a fiction, you know what it's like. If you're reading a bad fiction and you just don't care about anybody, then you're not going to go very far with it. It's trying to find that link with somebody.
No, it's interesting. I mean, I'd really like to write fiction too, but I do wonder how you sort of see all of those characters as individuals, and I find it fascinating how anyone can do that. And I have never read this book, the Stephen King manual on writing, so I must do that.
I do it. Oh, you'll love it. You'll absolutely love it. And I don't know. I think the character thing, I think I'm lucky in that regard that I get attached to the characters quite quickly. And there was a character in the book, Babies of the Rose, and there's characters that I'm writing about right now, that it's very difficult not, you know, I think it's very difficult to get away from them because they're hanging around you, and whether you're a part of them or they're a part of you, I'm not really quite sure, but it's sort of difficult. It's really difficult to get away from them, and you start thinking about them a lot, you know, and how they would react to things.
Yeah.
What to do now? Watch Stan's brand new horror series, Chapel Wait. You've heard why, and now you need to see it. It's based on the master of horror Stephen King's short story, Jerusalem's Lot. It's set in the 1850s when Captain Charles Boone, who's played by Academy Award winner Adrian Brody, relocates his family to his ancestral home, the infamous Chapelwaite, after his wife dies tragically at sea. But soon there are strange goings-on that can't be explained. Boone enlists the help of Rebecca Morgan to run the house, and that character's played by Schitt's Creek star Emily Hampshire. Remember, she's Stevie in Schitt's Creek. It's so great to see her again. The brand new horror series Chapel Wait is now streaming only on Stan. You can start your 30-day free trial today at stan.com.au. It's a mark of the depth of Stephen King's characters that, again, here we have now a miniseries, and we were just talking about Stand By Me, the film, which is based on a short story. But this is Chapel Wait is a TV series based on a short story. So these short stories have so much depth to them that filmmakers are able to create extended pieces of drama out of his short stories. And in fact, I've not seen I've not even read the short story that this is based on, Chapel Wait, but, you know, I know that they've used it sort of as a jumping off point. I guess he's given them permission to extend their imaginations beyond his original story, and they've used it as a jumping off point, and they've sort of added to it. And, you know, that just gives you an indication of how much he can kind of pack into a short story, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, it does. It does. And I think for him too, you're quite right. The shorter ones seem to be better. I think probably some of those bigger novels, there's just so much in there that it's difficult to, and look, I think one of those bigger novels, if it's one of his bigger novels and you've read it and you love it, the chances of them of being able to make one single movie that satisfies you from everything in that book is small. But but when you do it with a short story, he packs a wallop in those short stories.
Yeah,
I'm sort of surprised that he's able to write those whoppers as well, you know, those big thick ones of his, because he does the short story so incredibly well.
And this one, Jerusalem's Lot, has those classic themes that he loves to talk about. We're talking about a family with a curse.
Yes, he loves a curse. Loves a curse.
Yeah, he loves a curse. But he also loves that emotional territory of grief, of longing, plumbing the depths of love that can never be recaptured. All of those really deep emotional levels. It's all in here.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, pain.
Yep. He loves pain.
And children in pain. We've got children in pain in this one. Loves that.
He loves pain. He's very big on pain. Look, can you indulge me in just half a second? Because my second favorite book of his is The Dead Zone, which is about a guy who is in a car crash and he goes into a coma and he wakes up and he comes out and he has psychic powers. And for me, there's just one very short passage in here that just sums up King's writing. And this is the character Johnny as he wakes up out of, sounds like bedtime with Justin, doesn't it? Everyone sit around, I'll read you a quick story. But Johnny wakes up just out of the coma. He doesn't know what is going on, but he feels that he has these powers. And King writes this: that was all he had time to think before his mother's arms were around him, her violet sachet strong in his nostrils, and she was whispering, "Thank God, Johnny, thank God you're awake." He hugged her as best he could. His arms still had no power and no grip and fell away quickly. And suddenly, in 6 seconds, he knew how it was with her, what she thought and what was going to happen to her. And then it was gone, fading like a dream in a dark corridor. That's just got everything, hasn't it? It's got smells and it's got images and it's got desperation and the whole bit.
And we can feel it. We can feel what that hug feels like for him, that what it feels like when you have no power in your limbs, and that the discovery of having no power in your limbs. You're right. It's so evocative.
Yeah, he's great. He's just so good at that. And I think, and the other one, the my favorite book of all is actually the kids' book that he wrote. And when I say kids, probably more young, like teenage book, but the book called The Eyes of the Dragon, which is a real once-upon-a-time book. You know, once upon a time there was a kingdom, and in that kingdom was and it sort of starts like that. But it's bloody fantastic. You know, it's just, and I wouldn't normally gravitate to a dragon-y kind of book, but the way he's done it is just so simple and, you know, sit down because I'm going to tell you a story kind of feel. I just love it. And I think, again, it comes back to it doesn't matter how you get to him. If you can get to him, try and do it.
Yeah, I think his movies are great for that as well. Like, you know, I mean, with Misery, which, God, I absolutely love that film. It's so good. I saw it at the cinemas when I was year eight, so I was probably 14 or something. But I'm going to show that to my daughters because it's, you know, they're at the age where they can sort of take a bit of that.
They can take a bit of hobbling.
Yeah, a bit of hobbling and a bit of, but I just feel like that's a thing, you know, often we say, oh, the movie's not as good as the book. And often that's true, but I think movies can be such a great entry point to go back to a book and encourage reading. And for me, that's exactly how I came across Stephen King. You know, whereas I know that there's people who've just gone hardcore into his books.
Yeah, and as we were saying, if there are good movies and good sort of representations of his work, they're very good. But then also, you know, things like The Shining. I mean, it's become lore. There's Stephen King lore. His career is so long. It's like you have to see the good with the bad and see the things that he liked and didn't like and kind of take it all in. And for me, part of it is the fact that he's still passionate about his work. You know, he's a guy who obviously never has to work again.
Yeah.
But he still clearly loves writing, doesn't he, Justin?
He does. And there's some great interviews around with Stephen King talking about these things. And the passion that he's got for sticking one word after another and trying to make it as good as possible and getting that, you know, that elusive white whale in writing, which is the perfect sentence, you know, he's still a person that strives for that. And look, I love him for that. And I think people like he and J.K. Rowling and you know, they've kept writing as a strong medium. You know, they just haven't let that, by making it popular. And I think sort of calling them popular almost sounds like an insult, but I don't think it should be. You know, they've made writing and reading, rather, they've made it, you know, fun for different ages and different people. They've kept them interested and excited. And I think, you know, we owe him a real debt for that, I think.
Yeah, and he's like, for horror writers, you know, I know that he spans different, you know, subgenres and stuff, but for horror writers, I mean, he is beloved and idolized, and I just think he's done so much for that genre, but also he's taken inspiration himself from, other writers.
And with that horror too, that, you know, I think, you know, like I was saying, that he's so sentimental, but he writes a good sex scene, and I think that's very tough. But he writes a good shag, and he swears beautifully. He's also a beautiful swearer, and I think that, you know, those things are sort of tough to pull off and still sound real. But he's able to do that. You probably hadn't
good
thought
points.
Of that. You probably didn't think we were going to talk about shagging and
well,
a Stephen King.
No, but I'm glad we are, because I often wonder how you write a sex scene. I mean, have you written any in your books? I think I would find them, I'd find them really hard to write, because I think when my friends are reading them, that's what I'd be thinking when I'm writing them. Oh God, how embarrassing. Emily's going to read this and Justin's going to read this and Matthew's going to read this. And like all my friends, I'd be just imagining them and thinking, oh God, this is like, oh, they're going to think, oh God, how do you do that?
Well, actually, I didn't mind it. Em, you read Babies of the Rose. There's a little bit of shagging in there.
It's a beautiful book and edgy. Yeah, there's a bit of sex and it's done well. Like your main character, Grace, I just loved her so much because she was flawed, as all good characters should be, I think. But yeah, you just did it very lyrically. Like it was.
I'm sure you were thinking that Grace was having sex when you were reading the book. You weren't thinking Justin was writing Grace having sex, were you?
No, I was immersed in the characters, and I think I think that. And I'm the same. I don't necessarily like with sex scenes when I'm reading them. If they're really if they're really too full on, I'm like, nah. But if it's done just really.
But then if it's really basic, then I'm going to think, oh, no, now Emily and Justin and Matthew are going to think I'm basic when I'm having sex. Like, however I write it, I'm going to think it's a reflection on me.
Yeah.
Gee, Em, I don't know about you, but I'm looking forward to Michelle's first sex scene.
Exactly. I can't wait.
It's going to be full on, Justin. It's going to be, like, out there, man. It's going to be because I'm just going to think this is a reflection on me and I want everyone to think.
We'll have to amp up the dial. But, yeah, I mean – it's not something I've thought of writing, actually. I mean, I think
serious?
Of a lot of crime stuff or like tension and thrillers, but
they're always sexy books, Emily. They're always sexy.
I know they've got to. You've got to have a bit of what's the word? Frisson.
Yeah, frisson. Justin, how did you go about it? And how many times did you rewrite it? And how much time did you put into the sex scene?
Oh, gee, that's a good question. I didn't. It was. I don't think there's any. Anyway, answer that sounding odd, but I liked it. I liked it, and I liked it, and I didn't seem to struggle with it. And as much as I didn't say I'm going to write a sex scene here. I think we need sex. Martin Scorsese talks about a director, and I can't remember the director's name, but he said the director would look on the page of a screenplay, and if there wasn't nudity or sex in every five pages, he'd send it back and say, listen, can you spice that up for me a little bit? You know, he just deliberately put in sex and, you know, boobs and bums everywhere he possibly could, just because he thought that that's how you needed to make a movie. I'm trying to remember the mindset I was in at the time. I think I just felt that that's what they needed to do at the time, and then I put it in there. So I can't.
I love it. I love your relaxed attitude.
I love it. Flow.
No, love it. Obviously, I haven't even thought of a book, and I'm already worried about the sex scene, Justin. I mean, that just gives you an indication of, you know, where I'm
I feel like it's going to be really good, though, because you're going to be thinking so much about it. It's going to be very, very good. Yeah, I love it when, you know, when you see a movie you're about to put on, it goes, this film contains, you know, scenes of drug use, sex, nudity. Yes. And I'm like, yeah.
Nudity.
You know.
Yeah, and you go.
It might start with a sex scene. I mean, has that ever happened before?
Look, if the films I watch don't start with that, I go, hang on a sec.
My kids, you know, in primary school, they tell them to have a sizzling start, you know, when they're writing stories.
Yeah.
Sizzling start. You need to start off with something like, you know, his chest was heaving and it was a hot night. And, you know, that's all you need.
Remember, you're off. Remember when the old Mills and Boons and stuff and the, you know, the euphemisms they'd use for the, you know, the reproductive organs, you know, the steel sword or, I don't know, something bizarre, like, you know, steely sword and,
yes.
Michelle, are you getting this down?
I am.
Darling, you're writing this down.
Everything's always throbbing.
Pulsing and throbbing.
Everything's always throbbing. Yeah.
But yeah, it's I don't know. It's well, I think anything that's got you know, tension and horror, and particularly, I mean, with this first episode of Chapel Wait, I mean, it's got, like, that started very intensely, like with some full-on violence, and then you've got, and I feel there's definitely going to be romance coming up as well with it. But, yeah, I just remember thinking at the start of this, like, Jesus, this is bloody full-on, and it sort of
I mean, how's the cast? Adrian Brody.
All the brooding looks of Adrian Brody and Chapel Wait. So he's just, you can't keep your eyes off him.
See, listen, you're already halfway through writing a sex scene here.
You're so right. I'm having a sex scene, actually, as she's talking about Adrian Brody. Brody's brooding looks.
Adrian.
Yes, you're right, Justin.
Adrian Brody inspo. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Adrian Brody.
You just need a muse. That's all you need in this world is you just need a muse sometimes and you're away.
Yes. I mean, look, Stephen King has certainly informed our collective consciousness, hasn't he, with regard to the way this genre works. There's all of these sort of cues that we just understand, aren't there? And and he's invented a lot of them.
Look, he has. I think he has. He's written the rule book on horror that is horrifying, as opposed to horror that is just going to splatter blood on the curtains. I mean, and you know what I was saying before is he has written the rule book for making sure the humanity is always at the center of these things.
We're very excited for this one. The brand new horror series, Chapel Wait, is now streaming only on Stan. You can start your 30-day free trial today at stan.com.au.
Thanks to our guest, Justin Smith, author of Babies of the Rose. Thanks for listening.
This has been another Smart Fella production in conjunction with the Acast Creator Network.
Hello, Michelle Laurie here, and as promised, I am thrilled to announce that our tickets for Australian True Crime Live are now available. Join me in Sydney, Brisbane, and or Melbourne this July. You can come to all three if you want. These tickets are expected to go very quickly, so be sure to secure yours by visiting the link in our podcast bio, or you can head over to the Australian True Crime Facebook page. There'll be a nice link there for you. If you've been a listener for any length of time, you'll know how passionate I am about true crime stories from Australia. I'm looking very forward to an incredible evening together with you, sharing these captivating tales. We will have great guests as well, so you know we love a Q&A. If you've ever come along to an Australian True Crime live gig, you'll know we love a Q&A with our guests. Don't miss out. Book your tickets today, and I'll see you in July for a memorable night out.